There are new inspection rules for pig slaughterhouses, and some worry about these changes to a system they say is already flawed.
Consumers should be worried about the pork that they're getting under the current system and treat it with great care.
I'm Carol Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we're looking at how deregulation impacts the food on our plates. Plus, a judge says that a Coke plant in Erie can stay open after multiple clean air violations. But a group of residents is watching it closely.
We're getting a whiff of air pollution right now that I'll probably end up sending in a complaint.
And actors get into character as bats and other creatures of the night for a family-friendly hike.
I can't see very well, but I can really hear well because of my great big ears. Yes.
Keep your ears right here on the Allegheny Front. At a recent public meeting, the families of several people diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer in one Washington County school district demanded that state health officials do more research. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports the community wants the state to look more closely at whether pollution from the region's natural gas industry might be playing a role in a number of the cases.
In April, the Department of Health said it did not find a cancer cluster in the Cannon McMillan School District. But the state's tally didn't include one case where a patient's address was misidentified and two new cases from 2018. Many in the crowd told the department to update its study and find out why six people in the district had gotten a disease which only afflicts 250 people a year in the U.S. and which has no known environmental causes. Allison Cobb told the health officials to include the case of her husband, David, who was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma last year.
Until this is fixed, we get a clean report on environment and the effects, and you're including all of the patients to determine that it's not a cluster, I don't think we're backing down. You're just going to make it worse.
Carla Morado Cumming lost her brother Luke Blanick, who died of Ewing sarcoma in 2016. She said the department should study whether pollutants from fracking in Washington County had anything to do with the recent cases.
In the last couple of years, fracking is what's come around this area. Not only Washington County, but Westmoreland and Greene and Fayette.
A number of environmental groups have urged Governor Tom Wolf to put a halt to fracking while the state studies the recent cases. But State Representative Tim O'Neill said he didn't think that was a good idea.
Let's face it, at this point in Washington County, thousands of people are employed by the industry. Banning that overnight would eliminate thousands of jobs.
Sharon Watkins, the state's chief epidemiologist, said the department's findings could change next year when the 2018 data is added. But right now, she said, there's no proof a cancer cluster exists.
And we're not quite there yet. We may be with 2018 data. I still won't know why there's an increase.
Watkins said even if the state were to find a cancer cluster, determining a cause is exceedingly difficult. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Here's news that might put a sad face on your jack-o'-lantern. Heavy rains this summer have lowered yields for Pennsylvania's pumpkin farmers. Pittsburgh alone has received more than 42 inches of precipitation so far in 2019. That's 12 inches more than normal for this time of year. 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis spoke with some farmers that are dealing with the situation.
The biggest problem, heavy summer rains, which can spread disease and prevent pollinators from reaching crops. Adam Vole with Sorgel Orchards in Wexford says they lost a portion of their pumpkin crop.
Some of the stuff didn't get quite pollinated the way you'd like, and some of the temperatures were a little bit different too, which will affect the flowers.
Mike Janoski of Janoski Farms in Clinton says they typically grow enough pumpkins to sell some wholesale, but that won't happen this year. Janoski says Pennsylvania farmers aren't the only ones in a bind.
Ohio, Michigan, New Jersey, everybody has a very light crop. Some people have no crop.
Last year, pumpkin farmers dealt with rot problems because of heavy rain at the end of the season. Kathleen Davis in Pittsburgh.
We have more news about another favorite fall crop, apples. Apple trees are dying suddenly, and the cause has farmers and researchers stumped. For that story, go to AlleghenyFront.org. But it's not all bad news. Later in the show, some fall fun that's just a little bit scary. Stay with us. Along the shore of Lake Erie in northwest Pennsylvania, a plant takes coal and turns it into a key ingredient for steel manufacturing. But the coke facility has a long history of air quality violations, and state regulators have denied its permit to operate. The company appealed. Now, as PA Post's Ed Mahin reports for State Impact Pennsylvania, a small group of activists is working to make sure the plant either complies with environmental regulations or is shut down for good.
Watch it, there's a railroad. Another one here.
Some of the wildflowers in this overgrown field reach Mike Campbell's head. We're walking through it to get a look at the coke plant. This operation holds special interest for Campbell, a college biology professor and activist.
During the fall and winter and early spring, you get a pretty good view of this part of the plant.
He can see a red smokestack and an area where workers bring coal.
We're getting a whiff of air pollution right now that I'll probably end up sending in a complaint. It smells like a mix of rotten eggs and fresh tar.
Campbell and other members of a group called Hold Erie Coke Accountable launched a public campaign to increase pressure on the plant and regulators over pollution problems. In July, the State Department of Environmental Protection moved to shut it down. But the fight isn't over. On a recent weekday morning, big trucks headed into and out of the plant as birds flew overhead. Trucks like this, as well as trains, bring in coal so it can be blended together and put in coke ovens.
Coke ovens are a really a tenuous kind of monster. You know, it's huge, it's hot.
That's Ed Nesselbeck, Environmental Director for Erie Coke.
We keep it at temperatures of about 2,000 degrees. We just use the heat to drive off the impurities that are found in the coal.
But that whole process results in emissions, including benzene. Exposure to benzene increases the risk of developing leukemia and other blood cell cancers. And state regulators say Erie Coke is allowing too many pollutants to enter the air. In May, the department said the plant had nearly 80 unresolved air violations over 2 years. That includes what the DEP calls visible emissions. The smoke was too thick.
We will take strong action around that.
DEP Secretary Patrick McDonald says the agency's decisions are about the law and science. But people can help it investigate problems by making complaints.
We're not going to be out there anywhere 24/7. So having people within communities aware and communicating with the department is absolutely essential.
Which brings us back to Mike Campbell and Hold Erie Coke Accountable. Campbell lives about a 10-15-minute drive from the Erie Coke plant. He often heads down to the waterfront near the plant for bird watching.
It's a biologically diverse site because of the lake and the peninsula being right over there.
Back in 2017, Campbell and others marched as part of a climate change rally.
It's a joke. Erie Coke! It's a joke. Erie Coke! It's a joke.
In a video posted to YouTube, dozens are taking part in a protest at a boat launch near Erie Coke. He's also concerned about the Trump administration's rollbacks of environmental regulations.
Me personally, you know, I felt like I can't control what's happening in Washington, but I can definitely get involved in my own community.
The DEP created a stakeholders group in late 2017 as part of a permit renewal process for Erie Coke. Campbell joined. So did Sister Pat Lupo, a Benedictine nun.
There weren't a whole lot of people from that neighborhood, and I think...
After a few meetings, Lupo and others decided something different was needed.
That if we were going to really try to put any kind of pressure on DEP or Erie Coke, that we needed to have a group that was separate.
So Lupo and Campbell became leaders of Hold Erie Coke Accountable in August of 2018. Group members created a website and Facebook page. They raised about $15,000. they paid to create a video about the plant.
This particular area is actually a wonderful place for wildlife. If the environment was cleaner, it could be even better.
They worked with others, including Gary Horton, president of the Erie NAACP.
They don't let the issue go. It's not lost. It's not kicked under the rug.
A city council member said the group was influential. She introduced a resolution urging DEP to keep an eye on the plant. Campbell and others showed up to community meetings and hosted their own.
We clearly communicated to people what the procedure was for filing complaints right. with DEP when they observed or smelled something.
Now the plant's fate is uncertain. Erie Coke has disputed some of DEP's evidence, saying, for instance, that the department hasn't proven it is the source of smells that show up in complaints. But the plant says it has been working to make changes. Meanwhile, Hold Erie Coke Accountable says it is trying to gain more public support from leaders in the medical and business community. Sister Pat Lupo vows her group won't ease up on pressuring plant operators.
You know, even though at times it seems like, you know, right now we're kind of in a waiting period, we're not in a waiting period. We intend to, still keep in ties with the people on our email list, to still continue to educate where we can, and to still continue to move forward.
Back at the boat launch, the view includes Presque Isle State Park on Lake Erie. As your eye scans to the left, the red smokestack of Erie Coke looms. A judge recently ruled that the plant can stay open and keep on employing about 140 people until at least February if it meets certain conditions. DEP is contesting it. In the meantime, Campbell, Lupo, and their group will be watching for dark clouds or odd smells from the plant. Ed Mahan, State Impact Pennsylvania, Erie.
If bats could talk or sing, what would they say?
I'm a mammal, 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 and I fly. I'm the only flying mammal in the sky.
Bats, possums, and more nocturnal wildlife take human form in a special nighttime nature walk. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Stay tuned. Are new inspection rules at pork slaughterhouses a chance for innovation, or will they make our food less safe? Last month, the USDA quietly issued a new rule, changing meat inspection standards for pork. The changes will take effect in the coming weeks. They'll reduce government oversight, giving pork producers a bigger role in the inspection process, and allow slaughterhouses to run their processing lines as fast as they want.
What we're talking about here are some extremely massive facilities. Facilities that slaughter and process anywhere from about 15,000 to 36,000 hogs per day.
Tom Philpott covers food and agriculture for Mother Jones Magazine. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke to him for our podcast, Trump on Earth. Philpott says under the current rules, hogs are processed along the line at a rate of 980 per hour. That's 16 per minute.
You know, picture the hog being stunned and then this carcass going down the line and then workers immediately setting to cut it up, eviscerate it, pull the guts out, and start breaking it down. So these are facilities that are full of lots and lots of blood and guts and enormous animals being slaughtered.
What has traditionally been the role of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the inspectors there? And how is that changing now that the agency has announced these new rules?
So in the old system, you had USDA inspectors stationed at several points from the actual killing of the animal to the meat going out ready to be packaged. And so you had, you know, six or seven inspectors set up all along the process, visually inspecting, poking, sniffing, looking for diseased carcasses, situations where the evisceration didn't go very smoothly and you've got feces sitting on the carcass. What the new system does is it takes two of the inspectors out of the middle of the process and replaces them with company inspectors. And the rationale is that instead of all this visual and, you know, sort of sniff test that goes on before by the USDA, a certain number of the carcasses are pulled off the line for sort of random testing. Like, these are the points of the process where the biggest risk is. So we're going to pull carcasses off there, randomly test them. And if there are no problems are seen, then we'll just let it continue. You know, you're sort of surrendering the public's eyes on the floor to industry at some rather key points of the process. It really is part of, you know, sort of privatization efforts that go back to the Clinton administration. Back in the 90s, Clinton started a pilot process for hogs, chickens, and I think turkeys.
So can I ask, just to interject, who has been pushing for this? Is this coming from USDA or is this from the companies?
I think that's a really good question. And I think it's a little bit of both. Part of it is a sort of appetite for deregulation that has been in our government for a long time, let's say since the Reagan era. And I think the Democrats kind of acceded to it. But then the other part of it comes directly from the industry. And the reason why the industry has been extremely bullish on this since it started was that part of the deal is that when you remove these inspectors, these government inspectors, the idea is that, well, if we're not doing as much visual inspection, then we can speed the lineup. So, you know, earlier I said that we had about, you know, the average is about 980 carcasses per hour. And there was a government regulation that kept it at that speed. So you couldn't go above that speed. And what the new regulation says is, hey, look, as long as you can pass all these random tests that we're doing, you can go as fast as you want. And so there's been five plants doing a pilot process for about 15 years. So five gigantic pork facilities in the United States have been working under a pilot program. And the average speed in those pilot programs is about 1,100 hogs per minute. And one of them went as fast as 1,300 hogs per minute. So a significant ramping up of the line speed. And for the industry, that is very, very desirable because the more hogs you can send down the line as fast as possible, the lower your costs are. But the USDA, who's in charge of these policies, doesn't look at worker safety. That's a whole different federal agency. It's OSHA.
Now, what was that? Just to say, what was the concern and what is the concern for worker safety here?
Well, the concern for worker safety is that at current speeds, the rates of injury is massively higher than the national average. You get repetitive motion injuries. You've got people basically attacking dead animals with knives at high speeds. And so there is cutting. People get cuts. And so the idea is that already at current line speeds, the job is too dangerous. We're, you know, basically sacrificing people's health for our meat. And there is no rationale for speeding them up. They're already way over maximum. So this is a very dangerous job that they're making more dangerous.
This is moving forward under President Trump's USDA. But since it has been so long in coming, would you still consider this a Trump legacy, or is this something that was going to happen most likely no matter who's in charge?
That's a really good question. And I look at a lot of regulatory changes under that lens. Like, you know, is this specifically a Trump thing, or is this sort of the way the political system would have played out under, let's say, a President Hillary Clinton or a President Mitt Romney? Is this sort of a more normal president? And I think that it's a little bit of both. Under a President Clinton, after the outrage over worker safety for the poultry under her predecessor, President Obama, I'm guessing she would have proceeded with this because the USDA has wanted to do this for a very long time. But I'm guessing that she would not have lifted the line speed maximum. So it is a little bit of both. It's, you know, part of it is just sort of the culture of deregulation that's been upon us for a while that President Trump is just taking and running with as fast as he can. And part of it is, you know, the specific Trumpian hostility to anything that might inconvenience industry that might improve or, you know, not actively step on the safety of workers.
And just kind of to finish up, should people be worried about the food they're eating? I mean, I just did a quick search online and saw in the past few days the USDA found a high health risk with pork products near Indianapolis, a recall of more than 700 pounds of pork products that might have been contaminated with listeria. I guess, would you expect more problems like this? Do you think consumers should be worried?
I think that consumers should be worried about the pork that they're getting under the current system and treat it with great care. I think that there is a high likelihood that a piece of meat that you bring home from the supermarket processed by one of these companies is going to have some pathogens on it, maybe antibiotic resistant pathogens, and it should be treated with great care. I think that with this new system and speeding up the line and taking USDA inspectors off the line, I would say yes. I would say that the concern would be even greater. So this has been sold by the USDA, going back to Clinton, very much through Obama, as an improvement in food safety. There is no evidence that it improves food safety, and there is pretty strong evidence that it decreases food safety from a pretty bad base. So, you know, basically, when you bring meat home from the supermarket, treat it like biohazard. Wash your hands, wash every surface it touches. Don't let other food touch it that you're going to consume raw. You know, that advice, it might sound like I'm some, you know, conspiracy theorist, you know, paranoiac, but that advice is from the USDA already. As you know, we're already basically taught to treat our meat like biohazard. And I would say even more so now with this new inspection system.
Yeah. All right. Well, Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Tom Philpott of Mother Jones Magazine. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant for our podcast, Trump on Earth. You can find more of the interview at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University. Celebrating nearly 30 years of preparing environmental professionals, the center provides multidisciplinary undergraduate and graduate education with opportunities for research and internships, including the Environmental Science and Management Master's Degree and Professional Certificate programs. Applications for the spring and summer semesters are now being accepted. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
The spookiest sounds of the Halloween season don't come from horror movies. They're made by wildlife at night. That's a red fox. Its scream is so disturbingly human that upon hearing it, people have called the police, thinking it was the cry of someone in need of help. Young barn owls save their screams for right around this time of year. They're looking for a mate. When you're out trick-or-treating, you might hear a barn owl or two. Or you could meet one, and other nocturnal wildlife. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis and her family did during a special nighttime tour.
My name is Rachel Handel. I'm the communications director at Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania.
All right, Mary, here's your firefly, and you can follow Mary.
We have an event tonight, which is a really fun event called Creatures of the Night.
It's kind of spooky out here at night.
We have miles of trails that people can walk on, and they are led by firefly actors who guide them through the trails where they will meet the actors who are talking about what nocturnal creatures do here at Beechwood.
Owl. Look, I think I see an owl.
You hear that out there?
Just waking up. I had a busy night last night. I was catching a lot of mice and things. An owl has no teeth. They eat the whole moth, bones and all. And then about 12 hours later, they regurgitate. You know what regurgitate means? Oh, wait a minute.
Oh, no, here
this is an owl pellet. Come up close. You want to touch it?
Okay.
See, this is the jawbone.
That's the jaw right there.
I think a lot of people are familiar with owls, but there are also flying squirrels, bats.
What's your favorite creature of the night?
A bat. Watch for bats.
Yeah. Oh, 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 look at that, look at that.
It's a bat.
Who is that? Come here, a little closer. I can't see very well, but I can really hear well because of my great big
ears.
Yes, I can actually hear all the insects I like to eat. Oh, yummy. I hate to brag, but I'm also very agile. So using my echolocation, even in the darkness, I can dodge trees and fence posts and buildings. I'm a mammal, 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 and I fly. I'm the only flying mammal in the sky. I eat mosquitoes, moss, and gnats. Oh, such tasty treats for bats. I'm a mammal, 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 and I fly. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Audubon's mission is to connect people to birds and nature through our programs, projects, and places. And the people who we love to see out are kids. And so, you know, at our events, we really encourage people to see the fun side of being outside. And this is a great way to do it.
I see it. It's right there, right behind that little thing.
Well, it's nice to see this many people in the woods at night. I know what you guys are. Do you know what I am?
Leopard.
No, I'm a possum, and I'm one of the few things out at night that's been around almost forever. I mean, they found bones of me with the dinosaurs. I can eat almost anything, because he's like the junk man of the forest.
This is an oddly warm October night, and so we are hearing some insects outside that we definitely would not normally hear in October, and I think that's a little bit of a treat, too. It kind of makes it more fun and a little more spooky at the same time.
My work here is done. We have cider in here. We have a screech owl in here. And thank you for coming tonight. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Thank you.
Are you a real reporter or is it just a costume?
She is a real reporter. Andy Cubis reported and produced that piece a couple of years ago. We also heard from Mary Iman as the firefly, Ken Miller as the possum, Paul Schmidt as the owl, and Karen Beacon as the brown bat. If you'd like to meet some of these delightful creatures of the night yourself, the event is happening again this year. For dates and times, head to AlleghenyFront.org. If you dare. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Our show is also a podcast. If you missed an episode or want to hear one again, find the Allegheny Front podcast each week at our website, AlleghenyFront.org/podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Colcom Foundation, the Park Foundation, and the Curtis and Edith Munson Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. Our Trump on Earth podcast is supported by the Robert F. Schumann Foundation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.